Reubens, ice cream sandwiches, and paper-thin wedges of pizza bigger than my head. I ate a deep-fried turkey leg from a food truck parked beside a crowded man-made lake. The trail even goes through a real zoo at one point, the lowest on the entire trail, both in elevation and in mood. Just before crossing the Hudson River up near West Point, less than 10 steps past the sign proudly announcing the AT's literal rock bottom, it's in a tunnel beneath a busy road, a black bear languishes in a steel cage no bigger than the average bathroom. He has a dish of water, a log to climb on, and a hollow wooden cube where he usually hides from the cameras and shouting tourists. One of the zoo's hot dog vendors told me I looked like Amish Robin Hood. I smiled and ate my hot dogs while he and his friend pointed and laughed at my hat. One of my final camping spots in New York was a place called Nuclear Lake. The lake is so named because it was once the home of a nuclear research facility. In 1972, an explosion threw plutonium powder into the surrounding area. The government spent millions cleaning it up, and the labs have been razed. We know that the area is perfectly safe now because the government has been testing it for decades, and they said so. But, just in case, there are signs all around warning against drinking the water and forbidding camping altogether. My eyes and nose were full of mosquitoes, which had been swarming and biting me all day. I had misjudged how long it would take to eat that second funnel cake earlier, and now I was behind schedule. Now the sun would be down soon, and my only other option would be to keep walking past the lake at dusk, eventually night hiking through a swamp. I was done. I walked far enough into the trees so that I could no longer see the no camping signs or the trail, and then I walked some more just to be sure. As soon as I was secure in the safety of my mesh, I devoured my dinner, a 2-pound to-go container of bow-tie pasta and meatballs left over from lunch, and passed out shortly after. Crossing state lines always provides a morale boost, and getting so many of them in rapid succession compounded the effect. Another thing intensifying my sense of gaining momentum was the increasing number of SOBOs I encountered. The day I crossed into Connecticut, I met 6 of them. They were easy to spot. They were thinner and smelled worse than day hikers, but not nearly famished or worn out enough to be mistaken for a nobo. That and they were usually headed south. I wanted to be friendly and conversational while avoiding all the dreaded questions Kodiak had warned me against. "Going all the way?" I would ask, and was surprised by how often the reply was, "I'm going to try," or "We'll see how far I get." It had been a while since I'd heard that. Back at the start, plenty of nobos said they would try to go the whole way. But by now, anyone who'd said maybe had either changed their answer or dropped out. Connecticut would take a seasoned hiker 2 days, and I desperately needed to do laundry. Rainwater and streams no longer do the trick after a week or so. The guidebook had a lot of good things to say about a place called Bearded Woods, one-of-a-kind bunk and dine. I called the number and arranged for a pickup in Kent, only a mile from the trail. When my ride appeared, the driver introduced himself as Hudson. His dark hair was neatly combed and matched his trimmed beard, and he had the wiry, muscular build of a woodsman. Hikers climbed out of his back seat and thanked him, and I pointed them to the trail. Hudson offered to wait while I bought supplies from the small store in Kent, and when I returned, the van was full of new hikers, with one space left for me and my gear. As we drove, he explained the rules. He and his wife Lou ran the bunk and dine, and they didn't call themselves a hostel because they were, as their name implied, one of a kind. The flat fee included a shuttle to and from their house in the mountains, unlimited hot showers, laundry service, a real bed, plus a restaurant-quality dinner and breakfast together at a long table on their covered porch. "The way other places do it," Hudson explained, "they nickel and dime you to death for every little thing. And then what happens? You get people who don't want to pay for breakfast because they have some in their pack. They wind up out in the yard boiling water while their friends eat eggs. That's sad. At our place, everyone gets the same thing." Hudson was humble about his house, letting Lou explain to us that he built everything there. The walls, floors, and stairs were all beautifully handcrafted and polished hardwood. The floor of the entryway before the stairs was inlaid with a 5-foot AT logo. The walls along the stairs down to our sleeping area were lined with shelves of animal skulls, arranged by size, from the tiniest mouse to something with a football-sized head and pointy horns. They were all perfectly bleached, well-preserved, and mounted, a collection both grim and beautiful. "These were all given to me, found on my land or killed for food," Hudson said, "so I don't want you to think I'm some weirdo who collects skulls." The common area was also Hudson's work, and it announced his skills were not limited to carpentry. One entire wall was covered by a blown-up, high-quality photo he took of Knife Edge, a famous rocky ridge near the top of Mount Katahdin. The shelves beside the TV were full of books and DVDs, with a whole set of AT movies. I picked one called Flip Flop Flippin'. Hudson said, "That's a good one. I know the guy who made it. His name is Squatch. He just came through here not too long ago, making another one." There was also a row of books dedicated to Hudson's previous section hikes on the AT. He had done the entire trail, piece by piece, over a decade, he said, and this year he was doing the trail again, thru-hiking it all at once. "How is that possible?" I asked. "Unless you're already finished." Hudson and Lou, his wife, business partner, and trail boss, tag-teamed telling the story of his hike while we ate dinner. Big plates of pasta, salad, corn on the cob, and homemade bread, all cooked by Lou. He had started in February, one of only three people on the trail at that time. The ground then was almost always covered with snow and ice, and never any dry wood to build fires. The southeast had experienced several of the heaviest snowfalls on record that winter, yet Hudson persevered, cranking out 20-mile days. He was well into Virginia when the weather finally warmed up, and had walked past his house all the way to Vermont by Memorial Day. Lou brought him home, and they opened the Bunkendine for the season the following week. They were about to close with Labor Day approaching, at which point Hudson would pick up right where he left off. "Hey," he said, "maybe we'll finish together." "Yeah, more like you'll fly by me at an unbelievable pace." "No," he countered. "We'll be starting the whites around the same time. And the whites slow everybody down. Take whatever miles you're doing now and divide it by three." I'd heard this around the campfire often, usually by southbounders. We nobos were skeptical, and sometimes would even correct the sobos that they must surely mean subtract a third, not divide by three. The southbounders would reiterate that they had just been in the whites, and the northbounders would quietly assume their slowdown to be a sign that the sobos simply didn't have their trail legs yet. Hudson was about to do it for the second time, so I suspected he might know what he was talking about. Still, I thought, he'll be starting cold, no momentum. It'll slow me down by half, tops. After a delicious and abundant breakfast, I was loading my gear into Hudson's car when I saw something for the first time on the trail, frost on high trees. My breath was visible, too, on this crisp morning. Katie wasn't supposed to send my cold weather gear for another few weeks. But I shrugged off weather concerns, figuring I'd managed for half the summer with no sleeping bag at all. My final climb in the tiny state of Connecticut was Bear Mountain. It looked small on the map, and it was, but it was also the first of its kind that I had encountered so far. The tall pines to the left and right of the trail were beautiful and would have been the perfect backdrop for six or seven lazy switchbacks to carry a hiker to the top. But I was in the north now. Yankee trails, much like their speech patterns, were a window into the Yankee mindset, straight and to the point. The summit was less than 1,000 feet up, but there were no turns and it was all rock. It looked like a giant had taken the worst of Pennsylvania and tilted at 45 degrees. It was less than a mile, but it took me nearly an hour. I needed to strap my poles to my pack and use my hands in at least three places. I thought about throwing the poles ahead, but if I missed, they would tumble past me, and then I'd have to go back down to get them. My arms were almost exhausted when, just in time, the mountain stopped going up. I wasn't quite at the top yet, but I could make out the silhouette of someone resting at the summit. He had a strange head, a black cylinder that made him look like an old 1950s movie robot. As I got closer, I could see that his sleeves were buttoned at the wrist, and his pants were tucked into his socks. The thing on his head was a bug net. I had one in my pack, but I didn't like to wear it in the sun. It was hot under there. "I like your hat," I said. "Holy shit, it's Green Giant." The robot hiker ran toward me. "Oh shit, you can't see me. Ha, it's Bones." We hugged, and I could tell that he was still alarmingly thin. I thought back to the 4th of July campfire in Virginia when I'd last seen him, breaking down in sobs at the campfire at the thought of being forced to leave the trail. He had zeroed there 4 days until he was able to walk again. Now we were meeting again almost 1,000 miles later at the edge of Massachusetts. We hiked down the other side of Bear Mountain, where the trail was far less dramatic, allowing us to catch up on stories while we walked. In order to achieve what Bones admitted was an eccentric personal goal to hike the whole trail naturally, he hadn't taken any medicine, not even an aspirin, to relieve his shin splints. Eventually, he conceded. He had to make an exception when he caught both Giardia and Lyme disease at the same time. That was 8 days of just me lying in a hotel bed, crying and running to the bathroom. Those were the worst days of my life, he said. They're also why I have this stupid thing on my head. I'm not taking any chances on any bug touching any part of my skin for the rest of this hike. Over the 1,000 miles between here and where I had last seen him, Bones had suffered every problem a hiker could expect. But through it all, Bones had hiked as close to the center of trail as he possibly could and never missed a single white blaze. Never. Unlike the other hiker now with him on the same mountain. Let's see how this goes, I thought. I told him about my woes, my decision to yellow blaze, and how I had tried my best to catch my friends, and how terrible my aim seemed to be. To my relief, Bones was genuinely happy to see me, and otherwise had no opinion on the matter. I made these rules for me, he said. He was the true embodiment of the old hiker motto, hike your own hike. I asked him if he had any news from the rear. Voldemort was either still at my sister-in-law's or just getting back on, so he would have missed her, but Bones had passed Lemmy yesterday. That was good news. I knew I couldn't keep up with Bones and wondered if Lemmy and I were still at the same pace. Guess we would find out. Near the bottom, we found ourselves in a tight gorge following a tiny gurgling stream. We hopped across and found a small wooden sign covered in moss welcoming us to Massachusetts. Just behind it was a wall of mosquitoes. Bones pointed to his net. Maybe you should put yours on. For the next 10 miles, the mosquitoes were relentless. One persistent straggler buzzed incessantly by my ear, no matter how fast I walked. I was wearing my bug net now, too, which at least prevented him from biting. He must have known this and refused to land. I swatted with my right arm until it was too tired to continue, then swung my trekking pole back and forth past my ear like a metronome. This seemed to work for brief periods, after which he would switch to the other ear. Spider webs near the trail excited me, since I could walk very close by and let them clear me of any whining burden. Often it worked, but moments later another bloodsucker would take the last one's place. The word must have gone out through the Mosquito News Network that fresh meat was on the trail. I was the top story on Mosquito Net. It was all the buzz. Finally, Bones and I reached a pair of shelters, the Hemlocks and Glen Brook. The former is ancient by trail standards, a rickety wooden box that holds 4 to 6 hikers if they don't mind spooning. The latter is only a few years old and was fully occupied by a large group of college students on a freshman orientation trip. Many of them had never camped before, and they were quite curious to meet bearded freaks such as Bones and myself. We answered questions for about an hour by their fire before retiring to the smaller shelter just up the hill. Bones pitched his tent among some trees behind the shelter. While the site he picked featured a nice cool breeze, the bugs were bad there, so I decided to breach hiker etiquette and pitch my tent in the shelter, planning to move outside if anyone got in late. In my tent, finally safe from the swarming marauders, I relaxed for the first time that day and was asleep immediately. The sound of my trekking poles sliding down the wall and tipping over jolted me awake. Scurrying footsteps followed, the sounds of claws on wood with more weight than a mouse. I pounded the floor. Grr! Yah! I knew it wasn't a bear, but whatever it was didn't belong inside with me. Humans only! I yelled and roared again. At the start of my hike, nighttime animal encounters filled me with adrenaline that lasted hours. But I'd had so many by this point that I was back asleep in no time. The next noise that startled me awake was the sound of something being dragged, something heavy. I sat up and fumbled for my headlamp, feeling the floor vibrate with each scrape. By the time I found my light, I had fully emerged from the fog of sleep. That's not dragging, it's chewing. Something is gnawing on the shelter. I flicked my light and pointed it toward the sound. Most of the glare reflected off the tent's mesh, and the only thing I could make out was a brown shape the size of a watermelon. It quickly waddled into the dark. It looked way too big to be a beaver, and we were up high where there was no body of water to dam. I was almost asleep again when the thing came back and started gnawing on the shelter again. This time I was quicker. I unzipped the tent, reached out my light, and turned it on. It shone on an enormous porcupine. I turned off the light, pulled my arm inside, and zipped the tent all in 1 second. It continued gnawing. I had a hamster as a kid, and I remembered that it needed hard blocks of wood to chew on, otherwise its teeth would grow freakishly long. Porcupines are rodents. Maybe that's what it was doing. I was sleeping in a porcupine's chew toy. Well, he was here first, I thought. While the gnawing continued, I thought about the bear in the cage and the bear in the trap. They were here first, too. I was getting in tune with nature. If that meant letting a porcupine eat my sleeping quarters, then so be it. He wasn't hurting me. I rolled onto my side. For as long as I remember being awake that night, the porcupine chewed the floor. The rhythmic scraping made a soothing sound, and after a while, I didn't even mind how it shook the boards. My last thought as I drifted off was how Fiddlin' Jim snoring used to do the same thing. For the next 10 miles, the mosquitoes were relentless. The trail took me through some lower elevations, and when it did, they were there, much worse than the previous day. Now, instead of a lone wingman, I had dozens, and these ones bit. My head and face were protected by the net, but my arms and legs were host to legions of flying parasites. When the attacks first began, I was able to smack them. My arm hair glistened red. My blood or his, it didn't matter. In 95-degree heat, the sweat quickly washed it away. Hadn't there been frost a few days ago? In time, the mosquitoes began arriving in pairs, then in threes. Soon, I was covered. I considered doing nothing, but each landing site soon swelled into an itchy red welt. Instead of smacking, I tried rubbing them away, but that just created a thick smear of blood, bug parts, and sweat, which seemed to anger the swarm, drawing more winged attackers. I tried to run, but ahead lay only more mosquitoes. They were everywhere. I threw my pack at the base of a tree and rummaged through my laundry. I zipped the legs onto my shorts and tucked them into my socks. I put my long-sleeve shirt over my short-sleeve shirt, since the bugs could bite through a single layer. 10 minutes later, I had to stop again because the swarms had found the only exposed flesh for miles, my hands. Again, I threw my pack down and rummaged. I didn't have gloves, but I found my spare socks. As I was putting them on my hands, I realized I was now wearing every article of clothing I possessed, besides my raincoat. If I put that on, I really would die. I was soaked with sweat. It was hard to close my pack and buckle everything with socks on my hands, but I did it. For the next half mile, the bugs tried their best to eat me, landing on my sleeves and biting me through my shirt. Every few steps, I was slapping myself silly. I would walk some more and then run, then stop, then slap. I was going mad and I couldn't stop itching. My mouth was dry and I had stopped sweating. Dizziness started to hit me and I realized I hadn't been drinking or eating, just running and swatting. Lifting my water bottle to the edge of the bug net, I carefully pulled at the elastic around my neck and lifted just enough to get my lips on the lid. Mosquitoes assaulted my chin and neck, bit my ears, crawled up inside and landed on my forehead, but I didn't care because I was so thirsty. I was so thirsty I drank with one hand while punching myself in the head with the other, trying to kill everything inside the net that was biting me. My face turned pink and swelled. I gasped, then burped. I threw the empty water bottle on the ground and smashed the net against my skin, destroying every bug inside, grinding them into a pulp, smearing my cheeks. I felt a hot sting on the top of my foot and looked down. One of them was biting me through my shoe. "Die, you fuckers!" I cackled and fell to the ground, writhing, scratching every part of me I could reach. That's when Lemmy showed up. "Green Giant, there is a shelter right there! Run!" He grabbed my wrist and dragged me to my feet. A bandana masked the bottom half of his face, while the top half, well, the top half looked like a bear. A koala, specifically. "This might be it," I thought. "I've gone mad. Either that or Lemmy now wears a hat that looks like a koala and is saving me from mosquitoes. Oh shit, it's both." The shelter was at the top of a small pile of rocks and exposed to the wind, which helped keep the bugs away, for now. I left my net on, and Lemmy kept his bandana. Only his eyes showed. "It really is you," I panted. Lemmy's eyebrows were full of sweat. "These bugs. This is hell." He shook his fist at the sky and yelled, "Damn it, nature! Why?" I laughed, and he looked at me with serious eyes. "Green Giant, I am so tired." "I know, buddy. Me too." He swatted at his face and blinked. "This makes me want to be done so bad. I keep going and I keep going, and I ask myself, why am I doing this? I think about Katahdin, Green Giant, and do you know what I think?"
"What do you think, Lemmy?"
"I think it is going to be just one more mountain. I think I'm going to get there and say, okay, now what? There might be some champagne or something, but it will be just one more hard day. I just want it to be special, for real, you know? Different. I want someone to care."
"I care, Lemmy."
He let me continue. "I care, Lemmy. I really do. Let's do this together. Let's go all the way."
"How can you say it, Green Giant? That would be epic. But you see this?"
He pointed left and right.
"One day you are ahead. One day I am ahead. How can you know? We can't."
"Yes, we can," I said. I used my teeth to remove the sock from my hand and held out a fist. I extended one pinky and curled it.
"I will if you will."
He looked at my finger and scrunched his eyebrows. Sweat dripped.
"What does this mean?"
"Pinky swear. It means we have to do whatever we say." I held it out further. Lemmy curled his pinky finger and linked it with mine.
"Are we married now?"
"Yes. Now listen. Whoever gets to Mount Katahdin first waits for the other one."
"What if it is like 6 months?"
I sighed. "Okay, 2-day limit. How's that sound? I'll camp out and wait for you if I get there first, and you do the same. Deal?" The koala nodded.
"Deal."
"Pinky swear?"
"Pinky swear."
It was done. No matter what, Lemmy and I were going to climb Mount Katahdin together. I lost him at the next water stop, and when I woke up the next day, I had no idea where he was.
Chapter 21. Enter the Ninja. For the next 60 miles, Lemmy and I went back to leapfrogging each other, but trading places for days now instead of hours. The little ups and downs were still getting bigger, and many of the climbs had taken on the rocky, straight-to-the-top approach I saw back at Bear Mountain. The lowlands in between were marshy and plagued by mosquitoes, especially at the wide, slow streams the color of weak tea. About halfway through Massachusetts, the AT passes through the center of Dalton. All of the marshes had ruined my socks, and my pants had collected enough mud that when they baked in the sun, they turned into something like pottery shin guards. According to the guidebook, a gentleman named Tom Lavardi allowed hikers to spend the night on his porch or in his yard, as long as they checked in with him first before showing up. Then I called Katie, who told me her sister had just dropped off Megan near Nuclear Lake. After descending a steep, muddy slope, the white blazes took me down a tree-lined street where immaculate lawns grew between tiny houses with steep roofs. After a few blocks, I arrived at a house with lots of tents in the yard and climbed the steps to the porch, where I met a young man with glasses and shaggy curls named Breakfast Club. "This must be where the cool people hang out," I said, introducing myself. As we chatted, it turned out Breakfast Club had hiked with Lemmy and Voldemort while I was recovering in Lodeland 3 states ago. He smiled when I told him Lemmy was nearby and would probably arrive soon, then sighed with relief to hear that Voldemort was several days behind. "Don't get me wrong, I like her, but she's like ice cream. It's great, but too much of it makes your head hurt." I pitched my tent in the yard behind the house, and Breakfast Club showed me a garage full of bicycles that hikers could borrow. Choosing the tallest 3-speed I could find, I rode it to town with a sack of laundry on my back. On the way to the laundromat, I passed Bones, on his way back to the trail, after a night at Tom's. Once my clothes were clean and my belly full of pizza and donuts from the neighboring restaurant, I took a small sightseeing tour. It had been years since I rode a bike, and my newfound leg muscles made it enjoyable as well as effortless. Eventually, I found myself a little lost, looking at a map in the parking lot of the local VFW. A Mercedes with a white Marine Corps bumper sticker pulled into the parking spot nearest the door. When a tall man with white hair stepped out, I greeted him with, "Semper Fi."
"You a devil dog?" he asked.
I confirmed.
"A long time ago."
"What the hell are you doing out here in the parking lot?"
Get in there. Have a beer. This sounded an awful lot like an order, so I followed. The man never told me his name, but he put me on a bar stool and ordered me a glassful while we both stared ahead in silence at the TV above the bar, showing golf. Eventually, my host ordered another round and squinted at my beard and hair, now almost long enough to keep the bugs out of my ears. I was clearly not up to inspection standards. "What do you do now?" he asked as our drinks arrived. "I walk," I said. "I'm hiking from Georgia to Maine." "Didn't you get enough marching in the Marines, son? Why the hell would you want to do that?" "Who the hell knows?" I said, and took a deep pull. On the way back to Tom's, I passed Tupac. I steadied the bike and leaned on the curb. "You going to Tom's?" "I was thinking about it. I might keep hiking and camp north of town." He and Ninja Mike had sped by while I was sulking on a rock outside of Harper's Ferry. Now Ninja Mike was a day or two ahead, Tupac said. "You should at least stop by. Lemmy will be there." That sealed it for Tupac. It seems everyone had met Lemmy by now. "I'd offer you a ride, but..." Lemmy was there, and as usual, his tent was set up inches from mine. Breakfast Club was already asleep on the porch, so Lemmy stage-whispered from the yard, "Green Giant, we have to zero here tomorrow." "What? We're running out of time, Lemmy." Some of the leaves at higher elevation had been turning bright yellow. "It is for something epic." "It better be. What is it?" Lemmy reached into his pocket and pulled out a crumpled flyer with a staple hanging from one corner, something he'd obviously torn from a bulletin board. The 9th Annual Western Massachusetts Craft Beer Festival at the local fairground promised over 150 beers from 50 brewers, plus food and live music. Tickets were cheap. Tupac joined us just as I finished reading. I handed him the flyer. "Do you see what we're doing tomorrow?" The fairground was 2 miles up the road from Tom's house and could also be reached by several miles of trail that wound through the hills around town. Technically, we wouldn't be zeroing. We would leave everything but snacks and water at Tom's, hike to the festival in the afternoon, and then take the road back to our tents and be asleep before dark. When we were ready to leave, Breakfast Club was still in his sleeping bag on the front porch. He told us to go ahead and enjoy ourselves, but he was feeling too ill for a beer festival. Lemmy practically sprinted the whole way. Hours later, when Tupac and I arrived and were in the line for wristbands, he ran to greet us. "You guys, this is epic! I knew it would be!" His face was dripping sweat, and he had clearly taken advantage of his extra time at the booths. Once we were through the line, Lemmy gave us a tour. "Take a plastic cup, both of you. Now, watch this." We entered a long canvas tent, 50 feet wide and triple that in length. The sides were lined with display tables bearing signs, posters, and cardboard cutouts naming famous and obscure beers from all over the country. Lemmy picked one at random and handed the man his sample cup. "One beer, please." The man poured, explaining the recipe and history of the brew. When the cup was full, he drank just enough to prevent spilling and ran back to us. "Did you see this? They just give you a beer." Tupac grinned. "You did pay to get in, right?" "Of course. But I am going to try all 150, which makes them cost one penny each." His math was off, but it was clear that correcting him would be futile. "That's a great idea," Tupac said. "Let's get our money's worth. Green Giant, we have some catching up to do." "You people are insane. There's no way I'm drinking 150 beers and hiking tomorrow, or even living for that matter." Lemmy showed me his sample cup. "Look how small it is. You can do it." "No thanks. I'll watch." We started at the entrance and worked our way clockwise. Each time, Lemmy and Tupac asked for only half a sample cup, but at about 2 ounces per beer, by the time we reached the far end of the tent, they'd both had the equivalent of a six-pack each. I was already lightheaded from a single cup and marveled at their stamina until I remembered that they were both in their 20s. They were only getting warmed up. Tupac pointed back to the place we came in. "Let's see if we can make it back around to the other side in half the time. Speed round, go!" Lemmy dashed to the nearest booth. There was a line, so he jumped ahead to a display with no visitors, something pumpkin-flavored. I filled my cup once more and observed from a safe distance. It was like watching bees pollinate a flower garden. Following no clear pattern, they fluttered from one bright display to the next, drunk on sweet nectar, sometimes bumping into one another during landings and takeoffs. Their goal was 15 minutes. They did it in 10. I snatched a complimentary water bottle from a bin of ice and handed a pair to my friends. Lemmy drained his, burped, then smiled and swayed. Tupac drank slowly and pointed. "There are still 2 more tents." Lemmy wobbled.
We should...
He burped again.
Hurry.
I put a hand on his shoulder.
We should eat.
We found an empty picnic table at the crowded field between the beer tents and loaded up on fair food. I ordered a big, greasy sausage sandwich with mustard and grilled peppers and onions and a large, sickeningly sweet lemonade. When I got back to the table, Lemmy was giggling at his plate.
I know there's no dog in this hot dog, but why do they call it this?
I ignored him. There sure are a lot of people here. I mean, not just here, but even back at Tom's. His yard looks like we were at a music festival. Tupac nodded and finished his bite.
Dude, we are right behind the bubble. Ninja Mike thinks the center of it is up in Rutland right now.
Lemmy leaned in between us and whispered, "It was the cows." He leaned back and began eating.
I wonder if we'll catch them, I said to Tupac.
Probably. They'll slow down in the whites, and we'll speed up in Rutland. He scooped meat and cheese onto a corn chip and filled his mouth. I asked how we'd speed up, and he held up a finger and chewed.
Lemmy leaned across the table. Get along, little doggies!
He giggled and fell back into his seat. Tupac swallowed.
Ninja Mike and I are going to try to find work for stay in town and then slack pack for a few days. Really make some big miles. You could join us.
Lemmy waved the remaining half of his hot dog in the space between us.
This is a little doggy.
He shoved the rest into his mouth and chewed furiously. Once we made it to Vermont, the trail would continue due north for 100 miles, then take a sharp turn and head east for almost another 50, where it would enter the penultimate state, New Hampshire. That sharp right turn happens at Rutland, making it a strategic center for shuttles to and from the trail. Some call it Slackpacker Central.
Yeah, man, I'd love to try.
Lemmy lifted his second hot dog.
This thing is made of cows. Little hot doggies.
Good, Lemmy. We get it. Lemmy burped.
How many more tents?
Two. He stood up. I can do it.
That's the spirit, Tupac said, heading for a trash bin with our empty paper plates.
I want to see a bear, Lemmy told me.
I don't think we'll see one here, I informed him. I want to catch one. I want to catch a bear and ride it to the top of Mount Katahdin.
He leaned on me. I am serious, Green Giant. Tupac returned and pulled Lemmy up straight.
Are you going to make it, buddy?
Lemmy burped.
Yes.
I joined them for one more cup and then walked back to Tom's. Lemmy pleaded for me to stay and then called me a little girl when I insisted that I was tired. Then he told me I was pretty. It was hiker midnight when they returned. I was almost asleep when I felt my tent shake as Lemmy tripped over my stakes while he fumbled with his door. He heard me stir and unzipped my tent without knocking.
We did it!
I blinked twice and pushed his face away from mine.
That's great, Lemmy. 150 beers? Is there a prize? What did you get?
From three tents away, Tupac answered.
Kicked out.
Lemmy palmed a rock from the yard and put it in my tent.
Green Giant, look at this.
No, get that out of my...
Do you know how old this thing is?
Lemmy, go to... Green Giant, it is as old as the earth.
Lemmy... A dinosaur could have stepped on this.
I waited.
I am going to keep this. This is my dinosaur rock.
Tupac had been trying not to laugh, but this broke him. He sprayed spit and snickered. Someone in another tent grumbled and turned over.
Lemmy,
good night. He took his rock and zipped my tent.
Good night, Green Giant.
Lemmy and Tupac were already packed and eating breakfast on the porch when I emerged from my tent. Lemmy offered me a donut.
Damn you, 20-somethings and your stupid metabolism, I said, taking it.
Don't get too used to it.
Did Breakfast Club leave already?
No, replied Tupac. Tom took him to the hospital. All he did yesterday was sleep on the porch and not eat. That's all we know.
Damn, that sucks.
Yeah. Tupac had been hiking with Breakfast Club on and off since Georgia. There wasn't anything else we could say or do, so we changed the subject. We were eager to climb Mount Greylock, the tallest peak in Massachusetts, which would mark our first day above 3,000 feet since Virginia. After the rolling hills of Virginia, the cornfields of Pennsylvania, and the last 2 weeks of swamps, we wanted to see a real mountain again. It was 2 days north, and on our way there, we refined our plan for Vermont. At one rocky outcropping on the way, with the mountain in view on the horizon, Lemmy carved the shape of a foamy beer stein into his memory stick while Tupac and I pored over his guidebook.
I think I know how we're going to do this, he said, pointing at the big bend in the trail. Day after tomorrow, we'll be 50 miles south of Rutland. If we can get someone to shuttle us in, we can easily slack 25 miles per day, especially if we're eating town food every night. We could do the whole state in 4 days and 3 nights.
Insane, I said.
Where can we stay for 3 nights, eat, and get shuttled to and from the trail without breaking the bank? What about the Yellow Deli?
Lemmy looked over his shoulder, shook his head, and returned to his carving.
The guidebook didn't mention anything out of the ordinary about the hiker's hostel at the Yellow Deli, but the shelter logs had a mix of praise and warnings. We'd seen entries like, "Beware of the Yellow Deli," and "I think I just spent the night with a cult," next to "Hell yeah, Yellow Deli," and "Best mate on the trail." Even if they were a cult, it wouldn't be the weirdest thing that happened on this hike.
"Let's do it," I said.
The next afternoon, we reached the peak. A tall monument at the summit of Mount Greylock commemorates the state's fallen soldiers from World War I. There is also homemade ice cream at the gift shop. I ate 2 pints and began my descent. Lemmy and Tupac stopped short for the day, so I had the Wilbur Clearing shelter all to myself. The first order of business was water. There was a small stream about a tenth of a mile from the shelter, so I carried 2 empty bottles and my filter down the small hill and sat on a rock. I filled the small pouch and screwed it into the filter, then lined up the nozzle and squeezed. A jet of cold water sprayed from a tiny pinhole leak near the bottom. I tried to cover it with my finger, but as soon as I touched it, it erupted into a split 3 inches long, and water splashed out onto my leg and shoe. I stared at the useless bag. It was my third and final spare. I would have to boil my water. I filled both bottles and carried them, plus the remains of my filter, back to the empty shelter. When I took out my jet boil and shook the fuel canister, I was dejected to discover that it only had enough left for about 1, maybe 2 more boils. Barely enough to fill 1 of the water bottles. I put everything on the picnic table and folded my arms. I paced. The next town was Rutland, and that was a long day plus a hitchhike away. I only had 1 dinner left, dehydrated pasta. If I used the fuel to make drinking water, I could eat the noodles raw. It would taste awful, but I wouldn't starve. I sat on a log by the fire ring and thought some more. But if I got 1 bottle of water out of the jet boil and a dinner of crunchy noodles, I'd still need to drink tomorrow. Bad Dinner had boasted that he never used a filter. "The closer you got to the source, the less chance of piss or shit in your water," he said. I closed my eyes and visualized the tiny water source I'd just left. Had it been a spring or a stream? I couldn't remember. They were all starting to blur together. Mindlessly, while I pored over this new puzzle, I picked up some twigs that the previous occupants had stacked by the circle of rocks and started snapping them and tossing them into the ring. And then it hit me. I'm such an idiot. I can make fire. It was the one remaining thing distinguishing me from an animal right now. I broke more sticks and moved some of the rocks into a tighter circle to concentrate the heat, then started my fire. Once I had coals, I stripped the insulation from the pot and put it on my little stone stove, leaving an opening between 2 rocks so I could push twigs in from the bottom, sustaining the heat. It took 10 minutes to boil enough to fill 1 bottle. With socks on my hands, I quickly pulled the steaming pot off of the flames. Getting the water into the bottle was going to require precision, so I needed to wait for it to cool. While I waited, I thought about how much of a pain in the ass this was going to be in the middle of the afternoon next to some random stream with no fire ring or stacked twigs handy. Maybe Bad Dinner was on to something. It was getting dark as I was filling the second bottle when I heard voices. Someone was trying to find the shelter. I stood up and called, "Over here!" 4 hikers stomped their way through the bushes and into the clearing, 2 young men and 2 young women. The men had short beards, definitely less than 1,000 miles worth of whiskers, southbounders for sure. One of the girls asked why I was boiling so much water, and when I explained my situation, she smiled. "I have just the thing for you." She opened her pack and handed me 2 eyedroppers full of chemical water purifier. "Are you sure? Thank you so much. But what will you use?" She explained that between them they still had 3 more filters. "That only works if you manage to stay together," I thought. I wanted to warn her that they were barely 500 miles into this. 2 weeks from now, she might be the one hunched over an ashy pit, trying not to blow soot into her water. Instead, I thanked her again. As the 5 of us ate dinner together, I told them about my encounter with Kodiak, the first Sobo, and his reaction to the dreaded 4 questions.
They all laughed.
"We aren't jaded yet," said the taller of the two men. "We're still riding high from the whites, which are just as amazing as you've heard. Vermont's not bad either."
His buddy sat up straight. "But dude, Maine." All four of them leaned back and sighed in unison, exchanging smiles and glances, silently reminiscing.
"The place is just magical. I mean, I know there's mountains down south, but up there are mountains. And the flat stuff between them is like some kind of mystical fairyland from a coloring book or something. There are caves and waterfalls and lakes."
The taller hiker picked up the story.
"Moose, bears. I saw a fucking eagle, man. And it was summertime, so the weather was perfect almost every day. Those two skinny-dipped every chance they got."
The girls giggled. He went on for another 5 minutes, describing in great detail the hostels and the people and the animals. The more he spoke about the beauty, the more I could hear genuine longing in his voice. I had already been excited about what lay ahead. Now I actually felt chills when he halted, choked up, barely able to speak. His buddy patted him on the shoulder, and the girls slid in closer.
"I'm sorry," he said. "It's just that I miss it so much. My heart actually hurts from how much I miss Maine."
Three interesting things happened at the Vermont border. The first was the border itself. After climbing 1,000 feet, the trail plateaus for the final mile of Massachusetts. Then, right at the state line, the entire forest becomes a split level, like a cliff in miniature. Everything on the Vermont side of a neatly straight line looks like it's been pushed up exactly 3 feet. Either that or Massachusetts is slowly sinking. The second interesting thing was that the mosquitoes stopped. Vermont still had a few, but they were neither as numerous nor as aggressive. The angry swarm stayed on their side of the line, hovering there, mocking me. Their northern cousins circled my head lazily, rarely landing and never biting. The third interesting thing was the tall, lacquered sign welcoming me to Vermont and informing me that I was now also on the Long Trail, the oldest long-distance trail in the United States, spanning 273 miles from the Massachusetts line to the Canadian border. The AT and the Long Trail would share the same path for the next 105 miles, diverging where the AT makes that hard right near Rutland. We still had a day or two until we were within reasonable shuttle range, and we took our time. With another state came yet another change in terrain. Everything here looked landscaped, almost too good to be true. The streams were so clear they appeared empty. Flowers grew beside ponds, encircled by perfect pines, and everything smelled clean. The ups and downs that separated all these lovely scenes had become more severe, and the marshes were muddier by far. The pitch of our climbs was such that stopping to rest often required hanging on to something, and the low, muddy stretches were shin deep. Our feet made gurgling, sucking sounds with each labored step. Tupac and I had to help Lemmy find his boot twice by the end of the second day. We spent that night at a shelter just below 3,000 feet. The sky was clear, which gave us a spectacular view of the stars, but the absence of cloud cover made for one of the coldest nights so far. I was still tired when I woke up, and the shelter mice had chewed holes through my pants because I'd left an empty Clif Bar wrapper in one pocket when I hung them to dry overnight. I was shivering in my shorts and repairing my pants with tape when Tupac came into the shelter with his phone in one hand and guidebook in the other.
"I have good news and more good news," he announced.
I looked up.
"Tell me the good news first."
"Breakfast Club is back on the trail." I got a short text from him, and he'll tell us what happens when we see him in Rutland. He's hitchhiking up there today.
"Sweet. So what's the good news?"
"They're picking us up tomorrow."
"Who is?"
"Yellow Deli."
Lemmy, who had been drawing in the logbook, stopped and looked up.
"No, they are not."
"Sure they are," Tupac said. "I just talked to them. End of day tomorrow."
"They are picking you up. I am not going. They scare me." He went back to his drawing and would say no more on the topic. I put on my pants. "Well, I for one am looking forward to it. I need some real food, and I need to do laundry. Oh, and I also need a new fuel canister. And new shoes. And new trekking poles. Look at the tips on these."
"You need new pants, too."
"No, just more tape." After 1,600 miles, nothing was operating at 100%. Not a piece of my gear was anywhere close to its original condition. One of my trekking poles was bent, and both pointy metal tips had been eroded to mere nubs. One of the main buckles on my pack had snapped off long ago, forcing me to learn some new knots. My shoes would just barely make it to Rutland. My body was in the same condition as my gear. As soon as one part healed, another malady, twist, or sprain replaced it. My feet still hurt every day. Long ago, I had resigned myself to the idea that something was always going to hurt, and eventually, I accepted a certain level of pain as the new baseline. I could continue like this for another 500 miles, I thought, as long as nothing else major went wrong. The next day, we climbed up and over Stratton Mountain. We had to hustle, because our ride would be waiting for us 10 miles after the big climb. Lucky for us, we hit the peak early, and it was a long, easy downhill from there. The spacing between ups and downs was no longer regular, and judging by the guidebook, it appeared that this section was followed by hundreds of miles of erratic climbs and descents. This would be the perfect time for us to lighten our loads for a few days. Lemmy stopped at a shelter a few miles before our road crossing. We'd be covering a lot of the same ground over the next few days, so we agreed to use the logbooks to stay close. When Tupac and I reached the road crossing, a white van was parked at the trailhead. The driver's door opened the second we were in sight, and a slender man in round glasses got out and smiled broadly. His hair was tied back in a short ponytail, and his beard was trimmed short. His clothes were homemade, hand-stitched, and loose-fitting. "You must be Green Giant and Tupac. I can guess which is which. Please, let me take your packs. You must be tired. I'm Jan." He pronounced the J as a Y, Jan. Noticing our curious looks, or maybe just accustomed to explaining, he continued, "It's my Old Testament name. Kind of like your trail names. Hee-hee!" His strange laugh made us smile, and we gladly gave Jan our packs. "Please," he said, "get in." He never stopped smiling. I rode in the passenger seat, and Tupac sat behind me. Jan started the engine and turned onto the empty road. "I can tell why they call you Green Giant, but why did they call you Tupac? I only counted one, hee-hee!" When Jan laughed, Tupac grinned. "When I started my hike, my mom wanted to walk with me for the first couple days, but when we got to the first big climb, she had a hard time with it, so I carried her pack. When I got to the top, someone saw me, and, well, that was it." I twisted in my seat. "It wasn't an old guy with a triple crown patch by chance, was it?" Tupac shook his head. Jan asked Tupac what he did back in the real world. When he said mechanical engineer, Jan laughed his weird laugh again. "Wow, that's really neat. I've never met a mechanical engineer before. Wow." "Jan, I'm going to blow your mind, buddy," I said. "I'm a computer engineer." "Used to be." "No way. This is really neat. Two engineer hikers? Wow." If his smile gets any wider, I thought, the top half of his head is going to come off. The rest of the drive consisted of Jan asking us more questions and being consistently amazed by our answers. "Wow, I've never met anyone from Canada before. Hee-hee!" When we arrived in Rutland, I was surprised by its size. I was expecting another lazy trail town, but Rutland is the third largest city in Vermont, with traffic lights and sidewalks, things I had almost forgotten existed. The Yellow Deli was in the heart of the historic district. Beside the entrance, there was another door for the hostel. We took off our packs, opened the door, and climbed the narrow stairway. The walls were lined with postcards from previous hikers. The stairs were covered by thick strips of leather, each one its own unique deep shade. Burgundy, coffee, oxblood, and olive. A single white blaze was painted on the first step. "It's not real," Jan said, giggling again. "The trail is miles away." The bunk room had a tall, ornate wardrobe near the entrance. Jan opened it, revealing hangers and shelves packed with homemade shirts and pants similar to his. "You can wear these while you do laundry." The washing machine was coin-operated, and on a small shelf above it was a hand-carved walnut bowl full of quarters. The machines were free, our host explained, and if we ran out of quarters, he would refill the bowl. "You're in my house now, brothers. Here you pay for nothing." The long hall branched and turned, and I was almost lost when we reached the back of the building. "This is your lounge," he said. It was a well-appointed living room, furnished with leather couches and small tables. There was no TV, but there were books, games, and musical instruments. "I'll let you get settled. I hope you can join us for dinner tonight." The back wall of our lounge had a sliding glass door opening onto a large wooden deck that overlooked the courtyard between our building and the next. Down below, six hikers were trying to balance on one foot with their eyes closed and arms raised. A yoga class was in session. Breakfast Club was one of the students, and Ninja Mike was the teacher. He was wearing homemade clothes and headphones. His face was upturned, and he was steady as a tree. He lowered his hands to prayer and switched feet, and the class followed his example, or tried. Breakfast Club and another guy had to lean on their neighbor. Before he continued, Ninja Mike opened his eyes briefly to check on the students. Tupac caught his attention up on the deck, and Ninja Mike nodded and closed his eyes again. He inhaled, and the class inhaled. He raised his arms, and the class raised theirs. I whispered, "He doesn't talk when he does this?" "No, it breaks his focus." "What's he listening to?" "I forget how to pronounce it." "Ah, some kind of Eastern flute music or something?" Tupac snorted. "You would think. No, when Ninja Mike does yoga, he listens to Norwegian death metal." Chapter 22. One of Us. I was relieved when I saw Ninja Mike dressed like a pirate again. His clothes had been in the dryer, so after yoga he looked like himself again. I was worried that he'd become one of them. Not that there was anything wrong with that. Jan may have been a little giddy, but he and everyone else who lived there seemed friendly and genuinely excited to help people in need, especially hikers. Tupac and I joined Breakfast Club downstairs in the deli when Ninja Mike came down after his post-yoga shower. Our table was made from thick blocks of hand-cut wood, deeply stained and highly polished. Dimly lit walls were of hand-stacked stone or brick, ornamented with paintings depicting wildlife and nature, planets and rainbows. One bright mural covering an entire wall outlined the history of the group who ran the Yellow Deli. They call themselves the 12 Tribes. Members of the 12 Tribes tried to live their lives as simply as possible, practicing mercy and kindness and giving. They believed in charity and helping others as often as they could, giving until it hurt, and then giving more. They lived in communities, every member an equal. Breakfast Club finished reading the painting and folded his hands. "Okay, so that's a little weird." Then he told us what happened to him on the porch back in Dalton. It was acute pancreatitis, and he'd brought it on himself, he admitted sheepishly, from too much alcohol. "Good thing you didn't go to the festival with us." Ninja Mike took the seat beside me. A hot shower had left his hair as fine as corn silk, hanging past his shoulders. The purple headscarf was now embellished with a thin gold chain. His goatee had doubled in length since Harper's Ferry, and the curly tips of his mustache almost covered his eyes when he smiled. "I bet you have some stories," he told me. "I bet you do too," I replied. "Well then, let's climb a bunch of fucking mountains and tell them to each other." A middle-aged man in homemade clothes and a neat beard, short ponytail, and round metal glasses, matching Jan's, approached our table. He introduced himself as Aish. "Have you eaten? Won't you please join us for celebration downstairs? It's already started, but we don't mind. Please, come." And now we were already walking down the cellar stairs, Aish's hand on my shoulder and the other pointing the way. I didn't remember standing or even pushing my chair in. Bible study was just wrapping up. A young man, who also looked and dressed like Aish, had just finished reading a passage to a large circle of tribesmen who looked and dressed like each other. The only variety I could discern was that some wore glasses while others did not. Women and children sat among them, listening silently, with their hands folded in their laps. The four of us stood against the wall, observing. When the man leading the study finished explaining his interpretation, he told everyone to prepare for the announcement. "Our tradition is to have one of the children announce dinner," Aish whispered to me, "in German." A young boy, maybe 6 or 7 years old, walked into the center of the circle and yelled something in German, something that he had clearly rehearsed and was only slightly nervous about. When he finished yelling, all of the adults clapped and cheered. They leapt to their feet, and the room exploded into a flurry of activity. People stacked and carried chairs away to make room for 2 dozen tables that appeared from nowhere. Then the same chairs were unstacked and placed around them. Knives, forks, and napkins materialized, along with trays full of water glasses tinkling with ice. Plates of steaming bread and piles of whipped butter appeared. Aish tapped my shoulder, and before I knew it, the 5 of us occupied our own table with seats to spare. All of that activity, the well-practiced and perfectly timed restaurant-style hustle, was carried out by the women and children while the men sat.
Salads came, and more bread. There was corn on the cob, and a spicy chicken noodle soup. Ayesh insisted that we eat, and there was no reason to wait. All of the men were eating, so we did too. The food was amazing. It was better than any restaurant I could recall. The greens were as crisp and fresh as the ones Katie and I grow in our garden. The bread was warm and slightly crisp on the outside, the inside a steamy fluff. Ayesh explained that the tribe members grew and produced everything we were eating. The vegetables, the bread, even the chickens. Breakfast Club was impressed. You guys do it all, huh? Ayesh smiled proudly. Oh, we do a little bit of everything. Ayesh kept us fed, and someone else named Jan sat with us in the lounge after dinner, and again before breakfast. Apparently, Jan the First was assigned as our driver, because any time we needed to go anywhere more than 10 minutes from the deli, he was there with keys in hand. When he dropped us off at the trail the next day, he bid us farewell with his signature giggle. See you fellows tonight! Hee-hee! Tupac and Breakfast Club took off immediately, while Ninja Mike and I took time leaning against a tree to stretch. Those dudes are some spiritual motherfuckers, he said. On any other day, I would have balked at our plan. 26 miles, including multiple 1,000-foot climbs and descents. But this day, all of our heaviest things, tents, sleeping bags, several days' worth of food, were all safely tucked away in our bunks, awaiting our return. Ninja Mike was a few steps behind me. Hey, Green Giant, what was in your welcome basket? When we had returned to our bunks after celebration, each of us found a small, handmade wicker basket on our pillow. Mine had a bag of popcorn, I told him, plus an apple, 2 cookies, and some mate. He laughed. Of course. It was all they drank. Oh, and a card. Mine had a picture of a bunny. Each basket was decorated with a ribbon and a welcome card drawn and written by a child. It said, "We are happy to help." Dude, mine had a bird. It was so fucking sweet. I got a little choked up, I don't mind saying. I mentioned that I was surprised by how crowded the bunk room was. Oh, dude, he replied, the bubble is right there. He pointed to the horizon. How do you know? Tupac and I have been in it a couple times now. Miss Janet is there. Miss Janet is an AT legend, the ultimate trail angel. No one knows for sure how many hikers Miss Janet has helped. She ran a hostel in Irwin, Tennessee, for decades before taking her show on the road. But now, for as long as there has been a bubble, Miss Janet has been in it. She lives in her 15-passenger van and slowly migrates up the East Coast, shuttling hikers from the trail to town and occasionally hospitals, airports, and train stations. She is the queen at the center of the swarm. We caught up with Breakfast Club and Tupac, and when Ninja Mike passed them, he said, "We were talking about the bubble." It's like a constantly moving summer camp, Breakfast Club said, with no counselors and nothing but activities. The three biggest climbs of the day were tough, but they would have been tougher had we been carrying full loads. There were low-lying clouds that day, and each peak put us into them, denying us any views. The miles passed quickly, and when we reached the road crossing, Jan was there with keys in hand, as giddy as ever. Hee-hee! Celebration was only for the Sabbath. Tonight was just like any other night, so we ate in the deli. Ayesh sat with us, but instead of eating, he talked, encouraging us to tell stories while he listened. He was glad to tell us stories as well. When Tupac asked where they kept the chickens, Ayesh replied, "We have farms. Oh yes, we can see where the world is heading, and we strive to be self-sustaining. All this masonry, the wiring, even my glasses are all crafted by the brothers." He smiled and gestured toward the kitchen. Matthias was a plumber before he joined us. He helped build our deli in Gorham. I pointed at his glasses. You have some skilled brothers. We also practice many lost arts. Breakfast Club looked alarmed, but Ayesh reassured him. I'm referring to essential skills lost on most, spinning yarn or churning butter, for instance. After dinner, we went to the lounge, but it was occupied, and we only stayed for about 5 minutes. It seems that the only place that wasn't under the watchful eye of at least one tribesman was our bunks or the woods. The next morning, Jan dropped us off again, and again, with lighter packs, we dashed toward the pine-covered hills. Tupac and I looked up nervously at the clouds, but Ninja Mike had a different opinion. He leaned back, cupped his hands to his mouth, and hollered, "Woo-wee!" He waited for his echo and nodded approval. I am grateful for today. He sped up the trail, and we followed.
I wasn't able to keep up with them, but I was close. While they practically ran, I merely speedwalked, sometimes stopping to force the air out of my lungs and stomp like a horse. I caught up with them eating at the Cooper Lodge shelter near Killington Peak, just short of 4,000 feet. The clouds Ninja Mike had cheered at earlier now surrounded us in a whiteout.